Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of very personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place on the face of the earth to 1-877-876-5227 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at thespiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. And you can read my own blog at http://howtheneocons stole freedom.blogspot.com. While the powers that be in New York have as yet failed to make the long-expected announcement on Ada L. Smith, state senator from Queens, those in her district are beginning to awaken to the fact that she is an embarrassment to decent people and to the Democratic Party. The word is that the Democratic machine there will not be greasing her return to office this autumn. Sometimes progress comes in the tiniest possible baby steps. Also up and about to loom large on the political landscape, attempts to evade accountability that he so richly deserved for domestic violence and other behavior are now on point and about to slam into the fat face of John Fund, formerly and still actually connected to the Wall Street Journal, that overtly neocon outlet for disinformation. Stay tuned for more soon. And now our thought for the week ahead. Last week, we heard from Sean Hahn of North Carolina about the movement that's been going on for 3 years to help minor parties such as the Libertarian, Green, Reform, and Populist ensure ballot access. Sean shared with us the stories of their success, and we went on to talk about the very spiritual component of the work he and others have undertaken to narrow the divide between the spiritual nature God gave each of us and the tools we use to order the human world in which we all live. When we talk politics, we think of it as coalition. Coalition means coming together to take action, usually with people you do not normally work with or trust. That can be scary at times. But such action brings us closer together and begins to erase the chasms of distrust and misunderstanding that divide us. The communication this fosters creates something wonderful, and that's real trust. Trust builds a shared future that brings with it the possibility for prosperity, fulfillment, and joy. To come together for any purpose means that we really start to see each other differently. Instead of a predatory viewpoint, we see others as extensions of ourselves to be nurtured and helped. For each of us, this creates benefits we can obtain in no other way. To act in community, only through persuasion and consent builds trust. And a trust is a kind of moral capital to be used in many and amazing ways. Trust evokes an extension of belonging, an enlargement of our community in enriching directions. Trust is the soul capital that we fall back on when material things fail us, which they always do from time to time. Sean is continuing his work at building moral capital, trust, and cooperation into the world of politics by establishing and deepening that coalition, first on the ground of ballot access and then extending that trust into other areas. And there's no doubt that Sean is going to be successful because this is the thing that he does that he really, really loves. Coalition, that coming together to take action, comes in many forms. But any coalition begins with a single point of agreement that opens us up to listening, to really hearing, and cooperating on a joint endeavor that takes us home to God. Our guest tonight is Mike Hirsch. Mike's a longtime proponent of coalition, but he's also served as chairperson of the Montgomery County Progressive Alliance and the Maryland coordinator as assistant field director for the Progressive Democrats of America. Mike has also served as a board member and associate editor of the After Downing Street Coalition and the Maryland State Liaison, Democracy for America. Mike holds a JD from the Washington College of Law and an AB in government from Cornell University College of Arts and Sciences, where he served on the University Assembly and graduated on the Dean's List. Mike began his work from the liberal side of the spectrum. Sean Hahn last week started from the right. They both arrived at coalition. Mike is going to talk to us about the need for honesty in politics. Is it possible to bring accountability back to our electoral system? If so, how can this be accomplished? What if when you walked into that voting booth on election day, you knew that the candidate for whom you voted would keep his or her word? What would you do to make that real? Mike is working on that now, and we will be hearing about where those ideas are taking him and his group. Please welcome Mike Hirsch. Mike, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Melinda.
And Mike, we always begin by asking our guests to tell us something about their personal background. So, Mike, where were you born, and where are you living now?
I was born in Syracuse, New York, and I grew up just outside Syracuse. I lived there most of my life up until I moved downtown to the D.C. area to go to law school back in 83. And since then, I've lived in the D.C. area, and right now I live in suburban Maryland. It's just outside the Beltway, so I'm not affected by that Beltway madness that you hear about a lot.
How far outside of the Beltway do you have to be not to go nuts?
Well, it actually, there's a little bit of mythology about that. Most of the people who live within the Beltway are D.C. residents who don't have a senator, don't have a member of Congress. It's considered the last colony, and they have license plates out there now that say no taxation without representation. So the majority of the people in the Beltway are perfectly sane but disenfranchised. And then there are a lot of people who work for the federal government who are up to all kinds of chicanery, and some even mean well, but for one reason or another, as we've discussed, and as I know you've discussed with your listeners, they just can't get the job done no matter how hard they try.
Mm-hmm. And politics has been an interesting journey for you, isn't that true? You started out as a liberal, and now you've been rethinking some of those issues.
Well, when you think about the word liberal, I think that most of the dictionary definition of liberal applies to well-meaning people, whether they're on the right, left, center. I think most people do aspire to the ideals of liberalism. It's just that a lot of bad baggage has accumulated over the years, and a lot of mistakes have been committed in the name of liberalism. And so I don't think that I've moved away from being liberal. I just think that too many people who call themselves liberal have forgotten what that's all about.
Mm-hmm. So when you say liberal, you're not really talking about a particular way of doing it. You're really talking about an attitude.
It's an attitude, and it's also a commitment to certain ideals. And unfortunately, a lot of people who call themselves liberals have lost sight of the ideals.
Why don't you tell us about your vision of what those ideals are? Because I would bet that they're probably things that most of us would agree on.
Well, we've discussed this a lot just between the two of us, and I'm very happy to share that with your listeners. We both agree, coming from the right or from the left, that it's a bad idea to coerce people into doing things that they don't want to do. And what occurred to me was, if anybody's trying too hard to persuade me, and if they fail to persuade me, they're trying to threaten me or arm twist me or make me feel guilty or otherwise manipulate me into doing something I don't want to do, then chances are my gut is right, and the person who's engaging in this really kind of antisocial aggressive behavior is probably wrong. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I think that, it isn't that I think I'm any kind of a genius or any kind of a perfect person. It's just that if somebody is resorting to aggressive tactics and unfair tactics to get their way, that means that they're not confident enough in what they're doing to just do it and let me see by their example that it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And it tends to drive you apart, too, as two people.
Well, exactly. And it's a corrosive, corrupting way of doing things. And to me, it signals in a very profound way that the person who's engaging in manipulation, coercion, or whatever you want to call it, is wrong. Because mm-hmm. if they really had any faith in their position, they would be much more calm and peaceful and accommodating about it. And why would they even care whether I did it or not?
Well, would you say it's probably also true then that that people should want to know that any kind of deal, any kind of exchange is going to be good for both parties engaging in it?
Exactly.
That goes along with it, doesn't that?
Exactly. And a bunch of words spring out of that, like fairness and sustainability. Any kind of deal that I enter into with you or anybody else has to be fair for it to be sustainable. If it's unfair, if you're getting an unfair advantage or if I'm getting an unfair advantage, very soon one or the other of us is going to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't going the right way, and it won't be sustainable. Then what a lot of people do, and we've all seen this in our lives, is when one person realizes that they're getting really screwed over in a transaction and they don't want to engage in it anymore, then the coercion starts. And the person who's doing the coercion is adding insult to injury, really, or adding injury to insult, either way. And it's just they're trying to maintain a system of oppression and exploitation. Mm-hmm. And that's really where all the troubles come.
So absolutely true, and you see it in personal relationships, and you certainly see it in government.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So you would say that government shouldn't do any of those things that we shouldn't do to each other as individuals.
Exactly, and it's horrible enough when that happens in a personal relationship, because that's somebody who's, you know, a family member or a boss or a friend or coworker. If they're consistently resorting to coercion and manipulation to get you to do something that you don't want to do, then that's taking a toll on you. And that's where you're going to think of ways, consciously or maybe even unconsciously, to sabotage the relationship just so they leave you alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a plague in a personal relationship. Now, the relationship that most people have with their government is an increasingly impersonal relationship, and there's no check or balance on that, as we see. And that seems to be why the opposite of liberal isn't necessarily conservative, because you can actually be a conservative and adhere to principles of fairness and liberalism and openness. I think the opposite of liberalism might be neocon, because the neocons don't seem to want to have any check or balance on anybody. They resort to coercion and even violence really quickly, not as a last resort, but really as an expedient measure. And that's where I think that a lot of people who've been lifelong Republicans are starting to say, we need to take back our party from the neocons before mm-hmm. we don't have any party left.
That's so true. And so really it isn't a matter of being right or left or Republican or Democrat. It's doing the right thing, as you've just defined, or deciding that you're going to use government as a means, a tool for doing the wrong thing.
That's exactly right. And part of the problem is that people who've called themselves liberals have so empowered government, especially the federal government, as an expedient measure to remedy what they saw as terrible wrongs, like racism and exploitation and sexism and all these other different things. And for a while, government was sort of effective in mediating some of these problems. The problem is that sooner or later, this is always going to happen. When you have concentrated power, especially power that's running amok and is unchecked, unscrupulous people will find ways to turn it to their benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're much better off figuring out ways to empower ourselves as individuals to solve our own problems, either as individuals or as willing members of small groups that come together to clean up a mess and then go our separate ways, rather than have an institutionalized power center that is then answerable to essentially no one but itself.
Mm-hmm. Because then, of course, the people in charge of it are the least ethical people, the people who would be willing to use it just to fulfill their own greeds and needs.
Exactly. And there was a woman who was running for the nomination for Senate here in Maryland, and she's actually Greta Van Susteren's sister,
mm-hmm.
and her name is Lisa Van Susteren. She's dropped out of the campaign, unfortunately, but while she was in the campaign, I saw her at a number of forums, and one of the things she said was, as a psychologist, she understood the tendency of politics to attract people who had this will to power, this need to dominate other people, and it really did bring out the worst people to get involved with it, and then it brought out the worst in the people who were involved in it. And it goes all the way back to Lord Acton, where absolute power corrupts absolutely. What do you expect when you have that much power laying around? It's just too tempting to the average person.
So you're really saying that politics as it is today is an attractive nuisance that takes people who really are probably ethically challenged in the first place and brings out the worst in them.
Well, exactly. There are a lot of aspects of human nature where people are just not qualified to have control over other people, just on a basic principle. I mean, parents, we like to think parents will take care of their children because they love them, and then when the children get to be a certain age, it's time for the children to break out on their own. The problem comes in when people try to parent other adults who are perfectly capable of making their own choices and fending for themselves, and then we don't expect the governor of a state or the U.S. House of Representatives to love strangers. I mean, that's a lot to ask of anybody. So they don't have the same affection towards us that our parents did, and we're old enough to be our own parents. We don't need them to be parents. So we're asking them to do an impossible job that we don't even need them to do, giving them all kinds of power and control to do it. Well, of course, the thing is going to run off the tracks and become a disaster.
And so when did you come to that conclusion? Is this something that you sort of just always knew, or did you go through a sort of a process where you just saw this because of you were already political?
Well, I kind of came of age during the Nixon Watergate years, and it seemed to me that here were these very powerful people who had everything going for them. And even though Nixon was poised to win a huge landslide over George McGovern, he resorted to illegal tactics anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that that was very troubling. And that right there made me a little cynical about the whole operation. Then, under the Jimmy Carter years, I saw where a well-meaning person was relatively ineffectual, even with all this power in his hands. Mainly, I think, because Jimmy Carter wasn't willing to do the corrupt and malevolent things that other leaders have been willing to do, because he wasn't drawn to power for that reason. And it shows that if you have somebody who's drawn to power because he wants to coerce and manipulate other people, it's a disaster like Watergate. If they're not there to boss people around and manipulate and control people, and they're really trying to do well, it still doesn't work under Carter. So you have to scratch your head and say, if a good person can't make it work and a bad person can't make it work, who can make it work?
Well, then that certainly is, a frightening thought, because if nobody can make it work, then that means that our form of government is entirely wrong and bankrupt.
Exactly. And at Cornell, one of my first government classes, the professor said we should vote no for president and just leave the White House empty because nobody was up to the job. And what he meant by that was we had one broken presidency after another, starting with the Kennedy assassination. One after another either couldn't complete their term, or like Lyndon Johnson, wasn't able to run politically, even though he still had the eligibility to run. He said that he couldn't run because he screwed up so badly with Vietnam and other things. Then there was Watergate with Nixon. There was Gerald Ford, who vetoed everything because he couldn't work with the Congress, even though he came out of Congress. Jimmy Carter couldn't get out of his own way, and so he said nobody could even do the job. Then Reagan came in, and through masterful public relations and manipulation, and also because he was able to win the affections of most Americans, seemed to be competent in the job, but then you look at all the horrible mistakes that he made, everything from getting a whole bunch of Marines killed in Beirut to the Iran-Contra affair to the SNL crisis, trying to deregulate things without accountability. And even then, he's considered a hero by many people. So it's just, like you were saying, Melinda, it looks like nobody can get this job right, so maybe we need to change the job.
Yes, or change the form of government to something that, more clearly models what people can keep their hands on and control.
Exactly, or just let people do the job for themselves.
Yes. And so you've really gone through a transition, at least from the time that you were in college and that you started to see these things, and come to a position that a lot of people would actually identify as not liberal but libertarian.
Exactly. Well, I think that what I learned very early on is that the labels often confuse more than they illuminate. And for me, I've been told that libertarian was basically just a nice word for social Darwinism, which you just want to cut taxes, smoke pot, vote Republican, and screw everybody who's not like you. I've come to learn that that's not true. That's kind of the propaganda that people have used to keep people like me apart from people like you, and it's not working anymore.
And that's a very good thing.
Exactly.
That now we're really seeing each other. That's definitely an empowering experience.
Exactly, because it does seem like the most vocal liberals and the most vocal libertarians, the most vocal Republicans and Democrats and what have you, tend to be loudmouthed and like the part of the problem that we're all trying to get rid of by coming together in a coalition.
Mm-hmm. And there's a real mix of people out there today. And one of the people who's out there who's very interesting to many people is Cindy Sheehan. And you actually, she's a friend of yours, isn't she?
She is. Yeah, I've got to know her. I read an article that she wrote about how her son was killed in Iraq. And I was just really struck by how she really brought it home. I understood on a very intellectual level the waste and the death and the just the horror of this war, like any war. But she really brought it home and gave it a face and personified it in ways that I could understand, and I felt like most everybody could understand if they mm-hmm. listened to her story. And after I read that, I saw her at an event, and I didn't really know her and didn't really know that much about her. And she was just like going around randomly hugging people, and it struck me that she was a very giving and open person.
And she really is like that.
She is. And as I got to know her, and this was before the Camp Casey events last year, and this is before she became a household word, I spent time with her at events when other people didn't really know who she was, and we just kind of palled around because we knew each other and nobody was paying that much attention to us. Then the next time I saw her after she had been catapulted into this stratospheric celebrity that she enjoys now, I thought, well, maybe she knows me, maybe she doesn't, who knows. But she came running across the room to hug me and talk to me, and I thought, wow, this is a real person.
Mm-hmm.
She's the same old Cindy that she always was, and she really is. She's never lost that. She's never really lost sight of what her message is, which is a very simple message, and it transcends politics, it transcends religion, it transcends labels and borders and boundaries. It's really just that war is a horrible, horrible thing, and to enter into war is almost always, in every case, a horrendous, terrible failure, and it's just a big mistake. And unfortunately, the people who make the mistake are seldom the people who pay the price for it.
Mm-hmm. You don't see many of them going off to war, do you?
No, you don't. And you don't see, and many of them, when they have the opportunity to put on the uniform and face down a bullet or, put their life on the line for the country, they chose not to.
Mm-hmm. Now, they're moving Camp Casey to the D.C. Mall, you said, right?
Right. That's going to be coming up in September. And that's a very exciting event for a lot of us because just like I was talking to you about how her message transcends politics and labels and boundaries and barriers, we're trying to bring people together from all different perspectives to teach each other what we can, to work together, to learn from each other, and then bring people in from all over the country, educate them, empower them, learn from them, and then have them disperse back to their homes, their hometown, to make a difference there.
Mm-hmm. So what you're really talking about is a different kind of coalition, but it's the same thing. It's coalition. It's bringing people together to work and to understand each other and build a sort of community that will, you know, transcend distance across our country.
Yep, that's it exactly. I think that for a long time, Americans have been crying out for this community, for this connection person to person. And some people get that through churches, and some people get that through different civic organizations and clubs. And I think that that's terrific. But I think that a lot of people still find that lacking, and people are looking for meaning in their life and something to believe in. And we have cynical politicians offering us cheap substitutes like reverence for the flag, say, or some, you know, worship of some icon, some human being, which we're then supposed to hold up as a paragon of virtue, and we're supposed to submit to their desires and to almost worship them and follow them somewhat blindly. And that's all been a false choice, a false offering, and then we're consistently disappointed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do is look to each other for fulfillment and look within and try to make our own lives better. And instead of complaining about, oh, this leader didn't fulfill our expectations or that leader didn't make all our dreams come true, to not empower them or expect them to do that, to look to ourselves and to our immediate support group and our friends and our family
mm-hmm.
for that kind of thing.
And another thing we've talked about is the drawing apart of ordinary Americans and the political parties that has supposedly represent them. And you said that Cindy had considered running against Feinstein in California and that she has been critical of that mainstream of the Democratic Party.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. Well, there is a separation between the most Democrats and the power brokers in the Democratic Party, just like there's been the same thing in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this this gulf is opening an opportunity for people to connect with each other and not worry about the parties or any other intermediaries.
And sort of make them irrelevant, because in almost every way they are, because so many Americans simply ignore them anyway.
Exactly. A friend of mine who's was closely associated with Ralph Nader for several years says that it's his mission to destroy the two-party system. And I told him, I said, don't you think the two-party system is doing a good job of destroying itself?
That is so true. They are doing that. And, you know, much more efficiently than perhaps anybody could have done it from the outside.
I think so. I think that, and I've studied this for some time, it seems to me that the Republican Party is distilling and over-concentrating some of the least appetizing and appealing aspects of the neocon approach, which is basically just a very pragmatic, whatever we have to do to win, and screw our ideals, you know, small government, balanced budget, states' rights, you name it, anything that gets in the way of what they want to do, they sacrifice on the altar of neocon power. And the Democratic Party seems to have the opposite problem. They're not able to focus on anything. So it's just diffuse, where it's like, yes, we pay lip service to our ideals on the Democratic side, but increasingly, Democratic politicians are either unable or unwilling to focus enough to actually deliver on it.
Well, you know what it looks like to me? It looks like the Democratic Party expected their party to work like a machine, and they found that it doesn't work, and they can't figure out why it doesn't work, and they try to jumpstart it, and it doesn't work no matter what, and they keep trying to reinvent the square wheel, so to speak. But the neocons seem much less naive to me. They don't seem clueless. They seem like they understand that what they're doing is they're representing it as being one thing when they know perfectly well it's something else. So it's a much more cynical thing.
Right. I think that the neocons are essentially heartless and soulless, and unfortunately, the supposed opposition party, very often the Democrats, are clueless or gutless. And what we're seeing is a complete bankruptcy of the political system. And with a few notable exceptions, I mean, there's Ron Paul among the Republicans. There's Russ Feingold and a bunch of other good Democrats. But by and large, it's getting harder and harder to find anybody that you'd be really proud of voting for.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and of course that brings us to another very, very important point. One of the reasons you can't be proud is because you know they're liars.
Well, very often there are people like Ron Paul and Russ Feingold who both would rather lose. I think they'd rather lose their election than compromise their ideals.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't very many other politicians who even come close to that ideal.
That's so true, and this brings us to another one of the topics that we want to touch on tonight, which is the idea of honesty in politics, which for so many people today is a complete oxymoron. We just assume that politicians are going to lie, that if their mouths are moving, they're only lies coming out.
Exactly. Exactly. Most people, if you told them, how can you hold your politicians accountable? How can you, do you expect your politicians to, once you put them in office, do you expect them to deliver on their promises? Most people would laugh. Most people would think that you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We demand higher accountability and more honesty from lawyers than we do from politicians, and that's a scary thought.
And considering what most people think of lawyers, that is scary.
Exactly. Lawyers have to carry malpractice insurance. A lot of people don't know that, but lawyers have to carry malpractice insurance. And here in Maryland, and I think in most other states, you have to actually, at the beginning of every year, post a bond. So if you're handling any of your client's money and you keep it, your client gets compensated, and then they go after you as the attorney to make good on it.
But now, how does that process work for an attorney? Because you've been a practicing attorney, and you know.
Well, I haven't actually practiced, but I do understand how it works. And basically what they do is they ask you to put up a bunch of money at the beginning of every single year, and that goes into this huge fund. And the fund is there to compensate clients. Like, say, for example, you're my client, you sue somebody, they either settle out of court or we win, and they give the award, they give them the money to me. I'm supposed to turn it over to you after I take out the fees and expenses and that sort of thing. If I keep all the money and run away, you can go to this fund and you can be compensated.
Mm-hmm. And that actually compensates you for things like if your attorney messes up and because they are, they simply were incompetent, that can be covered too.
I think that's through the malpractice insurance, which is separate. So there's two different ways that we demand more accountability from attorneys than we do from politicians. If a politician lies to you, if a politician takes your money either as a campaign contribution and then does the opposite of what he or she said that they would do, or if they take your money through taxes and throw it down a rat hole or use it to attack another country that never posed any threat to us or doing any other crazy thing, what people will tell you is, well, you can just throw the bums out next time they come up for election.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that won't work for Bush because he won't be up for any more elections. And that also doesn't happen for a lot of the members of Congress who have an astronomically high reelection rate, no matter how crummy they are.
Mm-hmm.
The ones in the House have gerrymandered themselves districts where they're almost sure to win. And in the Senate, most of them pander so much that they're pretty sure that they're going to win, too.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of amazing that the system can work at all, because if you don't have a cause and effect, if you don't have liability and accountability, it's amazing that, that politics in America, it even works as well as it does, perhaps.
Well, we have more accountability from, the Motor Vehicles Department or something like that. I mean, at least you can complain to somebody and maybe get somebody fired who really screws up in the Motor Vehicles Bureau. But even then, it's very difficult to do, and you know how they're notorious for poor service.
Mm-hmm.
With politicians, there's not even that level of accountability.
Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no accountability, and you would certainly have thought that if they cared about that honesty and making sure that things went as they should, they would have policed themselves. But if you take a look at the, the committees and whatever they put together to do that, they're sort of a joke. Like
exactly.
A minute when we started the program, I was talking about Ada Smith, who's the state senator in New York from Queens, and she has done as much as batter her office workers with impunity. She batters them and then fires them and then maligns them. And only now, after I think it's 4 or 5 office workers that she's done this to, is there even a question of her being held accountable.
Exactly. I mean, the very few who have been held accountable at all have been notorious and even criminals, like Duke Cunningham and Tom DeLay. I mean, they had to actually been indicted or convicted to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
And even then they went out kicking and screaming and claiming that they were innocent and blah, blah, blah. It's horrendous. I mean, you wouldn't go to a dentist who is convicted of crimes, and even if you wanted to, there's a board in every state that would yank the person's license.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, doctors, anything, veterinarians, most anybody. We talked about how the people who come into your home with these different maid organizations or, different cleaning businesses, they have to post an honesty bond, and they're barely making minimum wage. And this is somebody who's sweeping up your house. We're talking about people in the House of Representatives who are making all kinds of life and death decisions over people, and they don't have any kind of accountability whatsoever.
So that's really what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about putting together the tools, the cultural tools, the business tools that assert accountability and force our system to confront this need.
Exactly. That's what it is. It's absolutely a need. Nowhere would you trust anybody with $100 or $1,000 of your money if they didn't have any reputation for honesty, if they didn't have any accountability, and if you didn't have any leverage, if they had just absconded with your money. But here we have trillions of dollars in this budget being handled by people who we know are notorious for being dishonest, for promising things that they have no inclination or intention of delivering on, and we just sit back there like, nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the reasons you can't really get Americans to even pay any attention to what's going on in politics, because it's so painful to watch.
That's a very good point.
It's
people
so painful
have lost
to even confront it that it's better just to turn your back and ignore it.
Exactly. It's so unpleasant. People have lost faith in the system, if they ever had any faith in it. That's part of why a lot of people are having an irrational reaction to the occasional flag burning, because at least the flag won't let you down. People can put their hopes and dreams on the flag. Now, admittedly, it's just an object. It's like, a graven image from the Bible or some kind of an idol. But at least people know that, the flag is going to take $1 trillion of your money and invest it in some cockamamie scheme that ends up costing everybody the entire wad of cash.
Mm-hmm. And the neocons, the people really in power now, they're using every one of the emblems that we love, that we've always identified with, that can bring tears to our eyes. And they've been, kind of shamelessly converting those things to public relations tools and using them against us. Wouldn't you say that's true?
That's exactly it. They've taken the concepts of patriotism and the flag and religion, and they've cheapened it into a slogan, like something used to sell soft drink or snack chips. And even worse than that, they've used that to go after people and manipulate people into doing things against our own interest. We have a lot of people who've been terrified into giving up their own freedom willingly. And this is a trend that we really need to reverse before it's too late.
Mm-hmm. And probably one of the things that needs to happen for that trend to change is for the tools to be put in the hands of the people so that they can feel a sense of power that should always have been there.
Exactly. I think we need to give people some hope. We need to give people a sense of belief and a sense of meaning in politics and our government again, get them in charge and get them back in power like they're supposed to be. This is supposed to be a democratic republic. This isn't supposed to be just a regime where a bunch of greedy, self-interested people can push everyone else around and trick people and manipulate people into doing things that end up hurting most Americans and America itself.
Mm-hmm. And you use the word, this is you know, a democratic process. It's a democratic country. And let's talk for a moment about how you're using the word democratic, because I know you have a particular way of using that word, and a lot of people have a misunderstanding about what that is. They look at it as being very strongly identified with a political party, and that's not the way you're using it, right?
Exactly. This is small d democrat, which means democratic really means people rule. And the difference between that and what we have now is now we've got a very powerful regime that rules the people. And basically, the real problem recently started when the Supreme Court, which was appointed by the president, and a lot of them were actually appointed by Bush's father, and Bush's father's friend, Ronald Reagan, picked the president. Then Bush, as the president, picked the replacements for the Supreme Court. There's no room for the voters to even participate. And to make matters worse, in the Bush v. Gore decision, they said, well, you have a right to vote, but you don't have a right to have your vote counted.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly an interesting point, isn't it?
And most people would say, well, what's the point of having a vote if you're not going to have your vote counted? And suddenly we're no better than Cuba or the old Soviet Union or Iraq under Saddam Hussein, where they all claimed that they were elected too, but it's just that it wasn't done by the people. And that's mm-hmm. not democracy, and that's where the difference comes in.
Well, if the people aren't really getting to cast a vote and they're not deciding, then it really is a very empty ritual.
Exactly, and it's also a closed loop where the elite picks some of the elite who picks the top elite, who picks the replacements for the elite. And it isn't just a matter of, you know, I don't like rich people, I don't like Republicans, or I don't like the way an elephant looks, or I don't like people named Bush, or whatever. These were people who had already been either selected by Bush's father or by Ronald Reagan, and some of them, like Scalia's wife, and Clarence Thomas's wife and Scalia's daughter, were already contracted to work for the transition team for Bush. So they should have recused themselves just on petty self-interest and conflict of interest. But this isn't just a Republican problem, and this is one thing that I've learned. There are Democrats who need to be challenged and who need to be taken out, and there are and Democrats really should do that themselves, because mm-hmm. if Republicans try to take out Democrats and Democrats try to take out Republicans, it's just partisan squabbling. We really need to clean up our own backyards.
Absolutely, because you're the one closest to it is always the one that has the most ability to do that. So in this particular case, because of the lock that the leadership in each party has on the party, it may be necessary for us to move to a context outside of the political, you know, the present political paradigm to make that happen.
Right.
So that we can make government honest and accountable.
Right.
Would you say that's true? Isn't this is, of course, where the group is going.
Exactly. And you might disagree with part of this. I think that we really do need to get the Democrats in control of one or both houses just to balance out the executive and legislative power, so it's not all concentrated in too few hands. I think that that's one thing that we do need to do. Even if you've never voted for a Democrat before, I think that this time you should hold your nose and vote for a Democrat just to stop the bleeding, just so there'll be some investigations and some accountability. And maybe there'll be paralysis at the federal level, but that might be a lot better than what we have now.
Well, actually, I have been thinking of doing a bumper sticker that says gridlock is good.
Exactly, and people advocated that. So, you know, when Clinton was in office, a lot of Republicans said that, and they had a good point. And the Democrats and Republicans kept an eye on each other a little bit during the Clinton years. And although there was a lot of squabbling that was distasteful for a lot of people, it was a lot better than a neocon monolith that just rolled roughshod over everything. And even the Supreme Court decision, which said, you know, you really can't torture people in Guantanamo. You really can't do these unconstitutional things and throw out the Geneva Conventions. They said, unless the Congress lets you. And it's like, that was really scary. And the press called that a stinging rebuke to President Bush. Not really, because all he has to do is go to his buddies Hastert and Frist and get it rubber stamped.
Well, and of course, that's what they've been doing.
Exactly.
Which shows you there's no control at all.
Exactly. So step one is to divide the power as much as possible so the people currently abusing it will at least get in each other's way once in a while, and that'll be better off for everybody. But that's only sticking a bandage on it. The real long-term thing is we need to build in this accountability, and we can start doing that at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, building in the accountability and starting to do it takes us in exactly the right direction, because it takes us to the place where people are thinking about the issue of accountability. Since they haven't been able to hold them accountable, it hasn't even been on the board to talk about.
Well, exactly. Just the very concept of accountable, open, or honest politics is an absurdity as it stands now. And we're really in a desperate situation because we've let this happen to us for year after year after year to the point where now it's not even expected. I mean, it's as if we hired a plumber to come into our house knowing full well that chances are he'd break as much as he fixed, if not more. And then people would stop going to plumbers, you would think. But we just keep going back to these same politicians, often the exact same people, and expect them to perform, even though we have no leverage on them once they get in there. We have no sense of accountability. We really need to assert ourselves. Because basically, if we all voted for somebody else, they would be out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the sense that the next person won't be any better that keeps most people from voting in the first place, or most people from voting for anybody with any sense of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can restore that hope in that direction, we can start to change the direction of the country. And the long-term solution, of course, is to make it so we're not empowering distant people to make decisions that affect us and don't affect them.
And this is actually what you're working on right now. You're working on a plan to hold politicians accountable.
Exactly.
And there's going to be an announcement about this soon.
Exactly. And the key thing is that once politicians are no longer able to make grandiose promises and then do whatever they want, the fun will go out of it for a lot of the less scrupulous people, and hopefully they'll find other things to involve themselves in. Maybe they can go, you know, get involved in, you know, fixing baseball games or football games or some other nefarious things that won't be involved with the coercion of the police power of the state behind it.
That's a very frightening thought, actually, of course. We want to make sure that there's accountability all across the system.
Exactly.
So that doesn't happen.
Exactly, and we can employ this template to everything else. You
mm-hmm.
know, we talked about plumbers and electricians and whatever else. We can certify everybody who, you know, go by, you know, profession by profession as honest and have these people put up bonds if they don't, or, you know, ordinarily do that in the course of business,
mm-hmm.
although a lot of them do. And just basically make people take out honesty pledges. And if they refuse to, that should be a warning sign to anybody who would want to enter into an agreement with them.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that, of course, another way that government has made the whole worse is that they've actually gone in and legislatively eliminated liability in the cases of many corporations.
That's a good point. What's called tort reform has done a couple of things. One, it's been a neocon effort to stifle criticism from Democrats, because trial lawyers tend to give money to Democrats. And the reason they do that is that Democrats tend to side with the little people a little bit more than the neocons do.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so there's that. Then there's also the fact that most of the huge corporations that donate to the neocons, and these huge corporations are inconvenienced that when their product screws up really badly and harms somebody, that they're able to sue. And they don't want to be held accountable or liable for the mistakes and even intentional things that they do.
Well, actually, if they're going and asking that liability be limited, they're building that into their corporate policy, that
exactly.
they will not have to worry about being liable for problems that their products cause. And so I guess the assumption has to be, as happened with some cars, that they're figuring it's simply going to be cheaper to pay off a few than to make sure the product works.
That's exactly true. One of the most chilling things that I ever heard was that Ford Motor Company knew that their Pintos were liable to explode and catch fire if hit in a rear-end collision, and they figured, well, let's figure how often that's going to happen, how much it's going to cost us to settle and lose some of those lawsuits, let's figure out how much it's going to cost to fix it. And because it was cheaper not to fix it, they just went ahead knowing that they were going to doom hundreds of or even thousands of people to a horrible fiery death or to, you know, life in as a partially burned person in pain and agony for their entire life. And they thought, well, you know, we're saving, you know, a nickel a car by doing it this way. Let's do it that way.
It's a really horrifying thought. And you can see that that's exactly where government is now, that it hasn't taken a look at its true relationship with us as a servant, that it started to view us as simply a source of wealth for them.
Exactly.
Which is, it's an abusive relationship in terms of the way they treat us, but in terms of the way, what this does to their spirits and their souls, this has got to be distortive, and it has to be putting them in a place of moral, what I call moral hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an obligation to clean it up for them too.
Exactly, exactly. Because right now, too many people in government see us as subjects. They don't see themselves as public servants. And that's the old monarchy, the old system that we rose up against, our forefathers rose up against in 1776. We weren't happy with that. At one point, King George III and the Parliament were willing to cut a deal where the taxes would be lower and the colonists would be appeased. But basically, what was intolerable for the people who took up arms, George Washington and the rest of them, was that they didn't want to live under a king.
Amen.
They didn't want to be subjects of a crown.
And now here we are living under King George again.
Exactly, another king, crazy King George.
Yes, and we are going to be doing something about this. There's going to be an announcement made very soon. And I'm going to put up information about how people can get in touch with you on my website. And could you give people a place where they can get in touch with you directly?
Well, you can post on your website, or people can contact me at MikeHirsch@MikeHirsch.com.
That's easy to remember.
It is. It's a little bit redundant, but it gets the job done. And that's H-E-R-S-H. There's no I. There's no C. People tend to make that mistake sometimes. And it's MikeHirsch@MikeHirsch.com. And we're going to have a huge, exciting announcement coming up once we get all the groundwork in place to really reorder the entire relationship between the electorate and the elected, and to underscore that they work for us and that they're accountable to us.
So well said. Thank you, Mike, for being with us tonight. And I'm hoping you're going to be able to come back after the announcement's made and talk about exactly what's going to be happening.
Thank you, Melinda. I'd like that a lot.
And good luck. God bless. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, Friday, July 7th, 2006. Tonight we looked at coalitions and what they can do and what they can dream. Politics is one lens through which we can see a far larger world. By coming together to create change and really understanding each other, we can change the world. Working with others in coalition opens us up to knowing ourselves in new ways that enrich our lives, that we can take our lives in directions we probably did not even imagine were possible. It's not an accident that so many Americans are turned off to that world. There is much to revolt and disgust, but like any other mess, this is one we need to clean up, so that forward growth can happen. It will take as long as it takes, and we need to keep that in mind. The idea of honesty in politics seems like an oxymoron, like Mike said. The work Mike and his group are doing now may well change that. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to show that government is just a tool, sometimes simple, sometimes complex, but just a tool we use to do the work we assign to it to do. It's up to us to decide. On this show, as we do on all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. That remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure those rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, It is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for right and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, to trust, and into community. May God be with you every step of the way. Good night.